Is November 13th, 1991.
Wow. We have to do it, Tech. We do it tomorrow. I'm very superstitious.
What's that? Okay. We could do it tomorrow.
Nah.
We're in San Juan, Puerto Rico. Right. I'm talking with Rudy Hernandez.
Right.
And Rudy, when I was growing up in Puerto Rico, as I mentioned to you, as a young boy, it was always my impression that all of the players that I was coming into contact with, following, were Puerto Rican players. And I've come to find out by doing this research that many of them were Dominicans. And I'd like to know at this point, tell me a little bit about your background, where you were born, where you were raised, and how you were first exposed to baseball as a young man.
Well, how you doing, Frank? First of all, I was born in the Dominican Republic. I was born in Santiago, Dominican Republic, and I left there at the early age of 12. I came to America, and I went to school there. I went to junior high school, I went to grammar school, I went to high school of commerce where I really developed my skills. I made all city in basketball. I found myself a good basketball player and I was a three-letter man. And I got the Lou Gehrig Award for being the outstanding athlete of the school. And in baseball, I didn't surprise myself because I felt that I've always had ability to play baseball. I had 450 one year and 385 the next year. And I played American Legion with the Eddie Grand Post. I played with the Brooklyn Against the World. I played with the Hearst team. So I was pretty well known in baseball. But in those days, basketball was more pronounced. And
In New York?
New York City, yeah, High School of Commerce. I was offered about 40 scholarships. And so I went to Seton Hall. After that, I went with my freshman year, the Giants offered me a contract. I had gone out for tryouts in Yankee Stadium, and the Giants were looking at me like I do now. I'm a scout for the Orioles. And they found that I had some talent to play professional baseball. So we sat down, we discussed it. They gave me a three-year contract, $6,000 in those days in the 50s. I signed in 1950. Mm-hmm. It was pretty big money, you know. And little did I know that if I got a penny over the $6,000, in 1 year, I would have had to stay on a big league club for 2 years as a bonus ball player. But yet, who knew then? There's no such thing as agents in those days.
Right.
You know, your father was your agent, and your uncle that knew something about the game.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I got my start, mostly. And going back to my childhood days, when I was in Dominican, you know, we used to play with a stick that was made out of a tree. You know, we cut it down with a machete. And we take a sweater and we take the threads out of the sweater and make a ball out of it.
Yeah.
Although my parents weren't too bad off, my grandfather was a general in the army at the time, and he was right hand man. And my father, who was raised in Europe, my grandfather actually was European. They came to settle the Dominican Republic, and he had a munition plant. So he sent my father back to Brussels and. So he studied in Brussels and became a banker. So he met my mother, who's Puerto Rican, and they got married in New York. My mother was Puerto Rican, New Rican, like mm-hmm. they call them now. And so my brother was born in America, and my sister and I were born Dominican, because my father traveled a lot.
When you left there at age 10, did you come to Puerto Rico or did you go to New York?
No, I went to New York.
New York.
Yeah, and I spoke no English at all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's why a lot of people think. They say, well, are you sure? You don't have any accent. I say, well, sometimes I talk funny. But that was my background.
Yeah. Is there one person or a number of people that you felt were primarily responsible for your development as a ball player back in your high school days or college days?
Well, you know, in those days, you didn't have many people. You had scouts, but you didn't have many people like encouraging you like you have now, you know, because of the money in the game today. Because there was no money in sports in those days. And you had a lot of in and out. But you had players that would play what they call a baseball bum. And guys that stayed in the game 5 or 6, 7 years was considered a baseball bum. Today, you know, it's a career because you can make money in the game.
Mm-hmm.
You can hang in there. And with the weight programs and the vitamins and the technology, a lot of the players are in their 30s. You know, my days when you were 35, 36, 37, you were practically over the hill, you know. Although there are a lot of guys that played late because they needed the money and there was no talent in the minor leagues, although there was 56 leagues then,
mm-hmm.
which now is only about, I think, 10 leagues.
Mm-hmm.
So you can hang around in minor leagues and if you want to be a bum. But I decided 1 year, I still had a good arm. I was 30, 35, 36, 37. And after I got released my last year, and I was 7 years in AAA, They offered me a $1,000 contract, and I said no because I was making $1,800. You couldn't make a living for five and a half months or 5 months in a AAA ball, mm-hmm. yeah, for $1,100, $1,200. That's ridiculous. Yeah. And now, you know, now they got the rookie A league and double A league. But the difference of those days and today is more players were eligible to play the game in the minor leagues. Now you don't. Now it's just a numbers. You know, they get them out of college, you know, mm-hmm. and they go right to A, right to the big leagues. But it's very difficult in my days to make the big leagues. There were only eight teams in the big leagues. But yet it was easier to make a living in the minors. Mm-hmm. You see, there was a lot of minor league ball players to choose from. So the quality of the players, naturally, because you had more leagues. You had three AAAs, you had five AAs, you had six AAA, you had D, C, B, A. So you had all those leagues where players were being developed. Mm-hmm. See? Mm-hmm. So now you don't have that. Now you have everything's fast. You know, everything's fast. And a lot of players go to the big leagues and they forget the mechanics, they forget the fundamentals, and you see the games on TV, guys going to third on a ground ball hit to the left side with nobody out, which is ridiculous. You see that in the big leagues. Pitchers not covering first base, you see that all the time. In the big leagues, in those days you didn't do that, forget it, that's a $500 fine, mm-hmm. you know. Today you see it every day. Why? Because these guys aren't ready to go to big leagues. The caliber of big league baseball today is not what it used to be.
You think guys could afford the $500 fine if they didn't cover first base?
Get it, boy. I tell you, I know. I know myself. You just got to keep your head in the game all the time. Yeah. Baseball was, you had to get, you know, rub your nose in the dirt. And like I said, to get to the big leagues, you know, you didn't get to the big leagues when you were 18, 19 years old. You got there when you were ready. Big league ball players, yeah, the pitcher, they used to say pitcher's ready when he was 25, 26. And I was an outfielder. See, I originally signed with the Giants, an outfielder. Mel Ott signed me, and I spent 6 years in the minor leagues, going up and down, double A, triple A, A. You know, I went up the ladder and down the ladder. Yeah. And 1 year I decided I came to win a ball, and Steve Rizek, who you told me you knew.
That's right.
Yeah, from White Plains. Steve is a good friend of mine, very good people. And Steve was talking to me one day. He said, really, with that arm you've got, people have always told me that great arm. Every league I let the league in assist. And today the technology, the technology today is different. If they see you with a good arm and you can't hit, it isn't I couldn't hit, but I didn't hit for the average, you know. The technology says they'll put you right in the pitcher. So it took me 5 years, and then I converted and I started pitching. I won 12 games in a row in Muskogee, Class D, and I went in the Army for 2 years. That's mm-hmm. what killed me. Mm-hmm. Then I came out 3 years later. I was playing in Double A with Chattanooga.
Did you play in the Army at all?
I play in the Army. Yeah, mm-hmm. I went TDY. I went to Fort Bliss, Texas. I was assigned to a Nike outfit, guided missile. Mm-hmm. So I travel a lot. I got out 2 months earlier for early discharge because of baseball. But you know, I didn't get to play quality baseball. You know, in other words, when I got out, I still had to go back a year to get myself back in mm-hmm. shape, mm-hmm. and especially a pitcher. You know, well, anyhow, to make a long story short, my career was cut short there for 2 years. And when I got out, I went to Miami Marlins in '58. And Pepper Martin was the manager, and he didn't think I could make his team, and he sent me to Double A, which was Chattanooga, and then from Chattanooga I went to the big leagues.
Yeah. You've covered a lot of ground there, and you've touched on some things that I wanted to get into. Did you play in the amateur league here in Puerto Rico at all?
Never.
You didn't play in that.
I didn't go through that.
Okay. So you touched a little bit about transitioning from minor leagues into the major leagues. When did you feel like you got a big break in baseball? Did you feel like you there was a time in your career where you had an opportunity to you talked about making the transition from an outfielder to a pitcher,
right,
and
right.
winning some games there. Did you feel that that was a moment that people were going to start looking at you?
Well, I always had a good arm, and I felt that if there was somebody around that noticed me was Steve Rizek. And Steve Rizek saw that I had a real good arm, and he said, really, you start pitching. And here in Ponce, when like I told you, Steve was the one that really motivated me to go and pitch. And he said, I'll teach you mechanics, I'll teach you how to, you know, which he did, and I'm very grateful to him. Mm-hmm. So I went to spring training that following season, and I told Carl Hubbard that I wanted to be an pitcher. And he said, no, we haven't given up on you as an outfielder yet. So I said, look, this is my fourth year, And no one picked me up in the draft because in those, you know, still today, if you're in the minor league for 4 years and the major league doesn't pick you up, they, you know, you're not considered a prospect because, you know, so I said, no one picked me up as an outfield prospect, so I figured I'm not a prospect. He said, well, we still consider you a prospect. And I said, so then he said, okay, I'll let you pitch. So I went out there and won, I won 11 straight ball games. And they couldn't believe in the organization. Then my hitting came around because I hit 450 with 8 home runs, driving 30-some runs. And I became Clint Hartung. In those days, Clint, I don't know if you remember Clint Hartung with the Giants. He could pitch and hit. And he was in our organization then. But I was getting paid to pitch, so, you know. And then from there, I went right to the Army. So, you know, those 2 years in the Army kind of cut my baseball pitching career.
As I've told you, I'm particularly interested in the Winter League ball down here in the mid-50s. And when you played for Ponce during that time, were there any North American players that you played with? I know you mentioned Steve Ryzdik, but kind of impressed you with someone who you thought was really going to be a superstar someday?
Well, we had, Roger Hornsby was my first manager here in the 50. Benny Hoffman was the coach. And we had, Clint Courtney was the catcher. We had Shoopy, we had Bob Marcus, played in the Texas League. We had Bill Scorum. I guess you know who Bill Scorum is. Yeah, he had played in college, and he got drafted by the Yankees. They gave him $100,000, and he came down here to play his first professional. In other words, he never went to the minors. He came from college to here. And I thought he was going to be a good one, and he became a good one. Mm-hmm. He became a star in the big leagues. Mm-hmm. And Carl Spooner, I don't know if you remember him, he was a left-hander with the Dodgers. Right. And he came to us fresh out of Beaumont. And he had a hell of a year with he hurt his shoulder, and then he couldn't pitch anymore, but he was another one. We had quite a few of Frank Robinson. Frank and I were, he played right field, and I played center field, and he's another great one that came through the Ponce team. There's a bunch of them, but I can think of, maybe.
My recollection was that Frank didn't have that terrific of a Winter League season when he was here, but certainly he went on to, be a
Yeah, well, what happened was that Frank hurt his shoulder. The ball hit down the line. I can remember it because he said, "Oh my God, I hurt my shoulder," and I told him, "I said, hey, get somebody else out there," and he kept playing the game. But the general manager, I'm trying to think, Bertie Tebbets came down and told him that he should go home and have that arm looked at. So actually, he didn't play that long here. I don't know where he hit 260, 250 or something like that. Well, it was he didn't have too many at bats anyhow. Mm-hmm. But he would have been a. He was a terror when he hit the ball, and the guy could see his potential that he was going to be a star in the big leagues. He had all the tools. He could run, he could hit, he could throw, he could do everything.
What do you remember about Clemente in that time? He was just coming up. He may have still been with Montreal in the mid 50s.
Bobby was a kind of a hitter. No matter how you pitched him, he'd get the bat on the ball. You threw a strike. I mean, your best bet was throw the ball down the middle, I guess, just like Yogi Berra. And I knew Bobby real well. And when I used to play him straight away. I couldn't play him to the left. I couldn't play him to the right because you didn't know which way he was going to hit. But he was a spectacular type of ball player. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a funny thing that you mentioned that because when he had the accident, they came to me and they did a series of interviews. And I was the first one they interviewed. Louis Olmo, his school teacher, his wife, and Louis Mayoral, which you know, brought him over to my club. I had a place called Rudy's on the Beach. And they interviewed me asked me about Roberto Clemente. And it was really, it was called I Remember Roberto. And Bobby was a funny guy, you know. It was hard to get to know Bobby. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he didn't trust too many people. No. In that sense, he was a kind of an introvert in the sense of the word. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he liked me a lot. Him and I are good friends. I had a place called Rudy's Tenthane Lounge and in Luisa Street in San Jorge, which he used to come over a lot. And we used to talk. And he would talk baseball all the time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So he opened a place up in Luisa in Carolina called La Carreta. And he would do the whole thing himself. He was really a perfectionist. Mm-hmm. You know, the sense of the word, that the carpentry work he did, he tried to get his fingers into everything. Yeah, he was quite a guy, mm-hmm. but his baseball ability, he was spectacular. Everything he did, he did in a spectacular way.
I wonder if he saw people on the outside perhaps maybe trying to take advantage of him or something along those lines.
No, he didn't let no one take advantage of him. No, he always had his guard up. Mm-hmm. That's one thing. Oh, yeah, he always had his guard up. He was very, he knew what he wanted, and he got what he wanted.
Yeah. You touched a little bit about the numbers of years you played in minor league ball. When did you make the transition from minor league to major league, and what was that transition like? What was the quality of the difference in the quality of ball and the whole ambiance about being up on the majors as opposed to being on the minors?
Well, what I found out, Jim Cott was my roommate. He was 17 years old, and we went to Nashville, the old Sulfa Del. It was a Cincinnati chain, and Jim struck out 19. And I guess the organization got all excited. They sent Joe Haynes down, who was the vice president of the Washington Senators. They sent him down to look at Jimmy. And it happened the night Joe Haynes came down, I was pitching against Memphis. And I shut him out. I beat him 3-0, hit a 2-run homer. And he looked at me, and after the game, he came by to me. He said, "You got good stuff." He says, "You got good enough to pitch in the big leagues." And I said, "Well, I'm 27 years old." I said, "You don't look it," because I didn't look my age. I mean, I'm 61 right now. A lot of people say, "You're 61?" Mm-hmm. But that isn't. I've always kept myself in fairly good shape. And I don't drink. I don't smoke. I don't never take any drugs. Or I don't drink coffee. I don't eat meat. You know, stuff like that, I think, could. And if you want to be young, feel young. You know, I don't want to get old, so I feel all that. And I hang around with young people, you know.
Now running a bar is a profession where you have to put in a lot of time.
I think 10 years in my bar business really put a little years on me. It put a few years on me. And it got me tired. I had a couple of hold-ups, and the last one I decided to quit everything. So I sold my bar business, But it was a good experience because I met a lot of top people in the world. I met Joe Louis, I met Joe Namath, I met Yogi Berra, I met Mickey Mantle, Johnny Bench, you name them, all the top stars. When they were in Puerto Rico, they came to Rudy Stenting Lounge, And I got pictures with them. And it was a great feeling to be associated with people. And guys I played ball with back in the 20, 30 years ago would come to Puerto Rico, and the first thing somebody, "Have you been to Rudy's?" You know, and so Rudy's was the place. Joe Decker was the rock singer. He had a song, "The People Stop at Rudy's," and he dedicated that song to me. If you ever heard "People Stop at Rudy's," and he dedicated that song. Joe Kubica was when I went to high school with him. So you name whoever, and it was quite a spot, and still people talk about it. Rudy Stenting Lounge, and so I got related to a lot of big stars in the game. And football, basketball, Wilter Still came in. Yeah, all of them. Every star athlete came into
my bar.
He just
came out with a book, Wilter Still.
He did.
I wonder if you might be in it. you were talking about that transition from minor league to major league.
Yeah, okay.
I was
in Memphis, yeah. And when I got back to Chattanooga, Joe Haynes called me aside. He says, "I'm going to see that you you get a shot at the big leagues." I said, "Well, whether I do or not, this is my last year in baseball," which it was. I was going to go back and finish school or do something because I was still young. I was 27, 28 years old. And a week later, I got a contract. I was brought back by Washington. So actually, Jim Cott was very instrumental in me making the big leagues. Mm-hmm. I was at the right time, right place. Right. If he doesn't strike out 19, Joe Haynes never comes down, mm-hmm. and I never get the break. So, you know, baseball is that way. I think it's that way for I wouldn't say a mediocre ball player. I'd say a player who's on the edge, and I was always on the edge because I always had a good arm. I had tools. I had tools to make the big leagues. But it's just a matter of somebody giving me a break or being at the right time, right place.
Mm-hmm. What was it like in terms of the relationships between the Latin ball players and the white ball players and the black ball players in the minor leagues and up
in the majors? Well, in the minor leagues, it wasn't too good. I mean, you know, when I was in the Giant organization, the black players and the Latin players, they would stay with Pompey. Pompey was more or less the guy that dealt with those guys. And they stayed, like I said, on the other side of the tracks. And guys like Willie Kirkland, Andre Rogers, and Manny Mota, Juan Marichal, all those guys, because they were all in the Giant organization. I mean, the Giant organization got the cream of the crop. And when I started playing pro ball, I'll never forget one time in the 50s, 51, yeah, I was in St. Cloud, and the manager came to me and asked me if it was okay to room with a black player. I looked at him, I laughed. I said, "Shit, when I was in high school, shit." I said, "Out of the first five, I was the only Latin. There were four blacks." And this is in the 50s, 51. He said, "Room him with me." I'll never forget this pitch. They say he threw lefty and righty. And so, you know, it was kind of funny. And we would go into the southern states, and they say white drinking, white bathroom, black bathroom, white bathroom, white counter. So I used to have a friend of mine named Johnny DeFresco, and we used to take these cans, these spray cans that they got now. They paint all these subways in New York with graffitis. And we used to graffiti. We used to rub out the white and make colored It was really quite a thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, it wasn't easy. It wasn't easy. It was really hard on the blacks and even the Hispanics. If you didn't speak the way of English and you were dark, they put you in the back, you know. And I picked up my language pretty fast, and mm-hmm. and no one took me. They took me for Italian, Jewish, Syrian, Lebanon. They took me everything. But one time, in Charleston, West Virginia, somebody said that. I said, yeah, I was dating a beautiful blonde girl, and this guy says to her mother, he said, well, you know, Rudy's cousin is Minnie Minoso. That's how ridiculous, mm-hmm. You know, some of these people thought about the Latins, you know, that Minnie Minoso was black as would be my cousin, you know. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, those are the things that you live with.
Yeah.
And I don't think it hurt, but the lads had a rough time.
Mm-hmm.
The language barrier was even greater than where it is now.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a nickname when you were playing ball? Kind of a nickname?
No, just Rudy, you know.
Rudy.
Yeah. In Dominican Republic, I was I used to goof on the people. They used to call me El Bello Rudy, beautiful Rudy, mm-hmm. you know. And I used to comb my hair on a mound and really, they used to have a picture of La Dama, a ladies' night picture. So, you know, Latin America, they always look for something to create. So it was cute, you know, it was cute, yeah. That's about it. But that, you know, that didn't last long when I got older. But still people see that, Nick. They say, mira, bello Rudy.
You mentioned some of the more difficult things about...
Oh, you asked me about between the guys in the big leagues, the whites and the lads. Well, you know, in Washington, when I was with the Senators, there was a lot of camaraderie, you know, between the players. Ramos was kind of a... He wasn't an easy to get along with, you know. He was
Pascual,
kind of
right?
Camila was he was the gentleman of all of them. Yeah, Julio Becker, Valdivieso. But still, you know, there's always a clique in baseball. It exists today, it'll always exist. Mm-hmm. You know, the blacks with the blacks, the whites with the whites. But it's always good to have everyone together. Mm-hmm. I think that the language barrier is very difficult today because a lot of Latins, you know, they talk Spanish in front of Americans, which I think is bad, you know. So that's a bad habit. It's something they should mm-hmm. yeah. And I remember one time I was in Pittsburgh and I was coming from the West Coast and I stopped over to see some of the players. I was playing with the San Francisco Giants, which were the Alouz. It was there was Marichal, there was Virgil, there was they must have about six or seven Dominicans in Pagan, maybe eight Latins they had on Pittsburgh Buffalo. And they all were in the room talking Spanish. And Alvin Dark came in and said, hey, Rudy, talk to them in English so they can learn. You know, mm-hmm. and everyone started laughing. Everybody got out.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, it gets to be very cliquish too,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
But still as a whole now, a lot of teams, they try to get together and try to express themselves as a whole team, you know, which is team spirit, which I think is good.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, behind those closed doors, you don't know what's going to happen. You know,
mm-hmm.
guys are going to say things.
Mm-hmm.
Point fingers at somebody, you know, say this guy didn't.
Well, you know, I've talked to some of the American ball players that played down here in the 50s, and I asked them, you know, did you learn Spanish? Was language ever a problem mm-hmm. on the playing field, whatever? And, of course, they weren't down here for all that long, just
pretty
a couple
months,
months. But you know, a lot of them didn't seem to make a big attempt to learn Spanish. And
no, very few. Like Al Smith was one exception. Carl Spooner was another exception. Hobie Landers was another exception. I'll tell you another one. Stan Lopata was down with Ponce. Mm-hmm. I'm naming some names I play with. Let's see. Les Peden.
That took a liking
that
for
took a liking
the language
to the culture and the people.
What about
Cat Deal? Yes. They call him the Refuerzo. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cat Deal, yeah.
Mr. Refuerzo.
You missed the import. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He took him by. He
mm-hmm.
spoke Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
Deacon Jones. He's one of my supervisors.
Mm-hmm.
He's a special assignment
mm-hmm.
in the big league club. He's here now with me,
mm-hmm.
and he speaks Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a lot of. I mean, let's face it. You're in a country where you
mm-hmm.
where you can take advantage of a second language.
Mm-hmm.
Why not?
And some of these ball players maybe had played one or two seasons here, but they also played in Cuba. They may have gone to Venezuela,
mm-hmm.
and so you would have thought that some of them might have picked up a little bit of Spanish.
Right.
We talked about the transition. What was, you remember Clark Griffin? Griffin,
yeah,
wasn't
Clark
he?
Clark Griffin was, yeah, he was the owner of Washington, yeah. He put me on the expendable list when we moved to Minnesota. When I went to Minnesota, and then over the next year when we had the new club, the expansion, the Washington Senators and the San Francisco and the California Angels, we had to put five players up for the expansion. So in order to buy each player, you had to pay $75,000. And Tex Clevenger, Hal Woodchuck, and myself got picked off the 25 man roster, mm-hmm. and we went to the new Senators. So I was with the old Senators, the new Senators, and the Twins. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was kind of cheap in the sense of the word that he didn't pay the players pretty well.
Was there a differential between the Latin players and the American players?
As far as money,
did everybody
concerned?
Figure they could go down to Cuba or Puerto Rico and pick up ball players for cheap?
Yeah, it still exists.
It does.
Oh yeah, yeah. Bonus players still exist. I think baseball, even today. Well, let's put it this way to you. Okay, I'm a scout. I check out a kid. He doesn't speak the language, so he's got one disadvantage. He doesn't play every day. That's another disadvantage. In the States, a lot of these kids are high school. They're high school baseball. There's no high school baseball in Puerto Rico. There's no college baseball in Puerto Rico. So we have a lot of disadvantages. So we got to get these kids. They usually sometimes they go to work and they got to study. So if they play juvenil, which is juvenile baseball, AA, they got to go and work out. They play Saturdays, two games. A lot of them want to go to discos. You know, a lot of them want to go out with their girlfriends. They want to go to the beach. And so, you know, the kids really like they got to have to like the baseball, mm-hmm. in order for them to really develop. So in other words, when I sign a kid at the age of 18, 19 years old, when he goes to the States, we give him, the organization, 2 years to really recuperate and to get into the swing of things. Well, in the States it's different. This is why American baseball, although, this is, I'm talking about Puerto Rico, although in Dominican Republic it's different. Here, you have to go to school here. It's compulsory. In Dominican, it doesn't. They got baseball schools over there. And they're much advanced. People say, how come Dominican ball players are better? They're not better. They're not better. They're more educated in basics of baseball because they play every day. They got 12, 15 teams, you know, and this is their life.
Sure.
Over here, it's not their life. Mm-hmm. They can become lawyers, doctors. Mm-hmm. They can be anything here. But Dominican, what else? What is it for a kid that comes from a poor family, doesn't have enough money to go to school? He can't be a golfer. He can't be a tennis player. He can't be a swimmer. Okay, that's out. Those are sports, the elite sports. Okay, so what does he do? He becomes a baseball player. Why? Because all you got to do is get a glove and a pair of spikes or a pair of shoes and go out there and catch and throw. And then if the kid happened to be talented, they develop his talent and they put him in a school. Here, you got to go to school here. In the ghettos, you got to go to school. Mm-hmm. And we have a big problem here with drugs.
Sure.
In those countries, you don't have that big problem with drugs because there's no money. And whoever backs them up, they find out who it is. And, you know, and over here, yeah, I mean, I know a lot of the kids that come back have no jobs. They signed, you know. In the States, it's just a matter of numbers. Mm-hmm. You know, they say, we signed 20 Puerto Ricans. 20 don't stay. 20 don't stay. I say one-fourth of them stay, you know. Because they have a lot of competition from Panamanian, Mexicans. I mean, right now, the field is wide open, especially Dominicans. And if I'm a manager and I see a kid that got more talent, I don't care what religion or what color he is. I want that kid. Mm-hmm. I want that kid. Who knows? He might be a Hank Aaron. He might be a Willie Mays. Mm-hmm. I mean, a Tom Seaver. You know, so this is what we look for, you know, in a kid to develop.
How different is the game today professionally than it was back in the 50s? I mean, you touched a little bit about what the kids are interested in today versus back in your days. Basically, you thought baseball and you kind of dedicated a lot of your energies in that direction.
Yeah, well,
there's a lot more distractions today,
yeah,
I guess.
A lot of more money in the game, more distractions. The kids are more advanced and as far as knowing what they want. There's more fields of jobs. In those days, baseball in those days was not a game that the parent would really want you to be, you know. Especially if you came from a family with money, they want you to go study. I know when I went to the Dominican Republic, I noticed a lot of these kids, you know, especially the white kids, you know, the white family, they were not, you know, because it was a black man's sport. Mm-hmm. It was a black man's sport. Because there was no money in the game. Mm-hmm. You know, television is what made money in the game today. That's why you have a lot of rich blacks, a lot of rich Latins. But if it hadn't been for television, baseball would have stayed in the same plateau. Mm-hmm. I don't think people would have really encouraged you to play baseball. And the conditions were very poor. In the minor leagues, you had to go busing 48 hours, 2 days on a bus, mm-hmm. in a half pint Greyhound. And no, the traveling was terrible. I mean, to pitch yourself out of the bus leagues and go into the Coast League and then fly those DC-3s around. Mm-hmm. We used to call them knuckleballs. And it wasn't easy. It wasn't easy. You know, you were young, but you had to get some rest, and you didn't get much rest.
A lot of these players are still traveling by bus in the minors, but they've got TV sets in the buses and air conditioning.
Buses are so cushioned, you can't believe.
Right.
Yeah, they're homemade.
Yeah.
So they don't. They got sleepers and everything else. You know.
What can the Puerto Rican player of today learn from you, from your experiences as a
Well, I would say today, get an education, because you don't know what's going to happen, because everything is just a matter of numbers today. You can be a good ball player, and I've seen a lot of them, and you can go to spring training and see what it is today, too. Latin players have a habit of talking English and Spanish in front of a lot of managers and coaches. And a manager or coach, he don't want no hassles, you know. If he sees a player that's got the same ability as you, he'll take him, and you're out of a job. So I would advise him, learn the English. Learn the language. Because they're going to teach it to you. If you're a good ball player, get yourself a roommate that speaks English. I signed 2 or 3 kids already. And the first thing I tell them, I said, don't speak Spanish in front of any coach because they'll think I'm talking about you. Mm-hmm. Get yourself an American kid. Mm-hmm. And if you get some, get the best kid. Don't get a kid that they might. Get a kid that you know is talented. A good hitter. Or you see a guy throw a ball hard. A guy can run good. Get a kid that's got some talent. Then associate with him. Mm-hmm. No matter what color he is. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, color in baseball today has no bearings on talent. And I would advise that. And keep good health habits, you know. Mm-hmm. Don't get involved in any bad doings, you know. Because they watch. That character is very important. When I signed a kid, they asked me, what kind of a kid is he? I signed Roberto Clemente Jr. And the first thing they asked me, Rudy, what kind of a kid is he? Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, he had been signed before. He was 24 years old. And George Foster had told him, he went to George Foster School in the States. And then I called George Foster. He said, Rudy, I hadn't seen Roberto Clemente Jr. in a long time. And when he signed, he was 19 years old. And he decided that he wanted to play ball. So he went to the weight program. That's another thing that's helped a lot of players today, the weight program, which we didn't have. And I signed him. And I had to start him at double-A ball level. And he hurt his back. He never even went out and swung the bat. Mm-hmm. So unfortunately, he didn't get a chance to even show himself because, you know, when you're that age, they got to start you on a higher level ball. They can't put you with the rookies. They can't put you with school fundamentals. You know, they got to start you on a higher level.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sure. Because today the grade of baseball is so fast that they give you 2 or 3 years, you're gone. There's a lot of athletes, a lot of ball players. Mm-hmm. With the expansion, I don't know what's going to happen with the expansion. I don't think there's going to be enough qualified ball players to see Major League caliber. You don't see it now. You don't see Major League caliber in baseball no more. Mm-hmm. No way. No way.
You don't think the caliber today is as good as it was?
No.
You know, I hear that from a lot of the players.
No, never. Never. And it'll never be. It'll never be because most of the players today come from college, less experienced. No minor league backgrounds. You know, 1 year, 2 years, they're in the big leagues. The disabled list is something that's incredible. You know, everyone goes on the big money ball players. They're signed for 5-6 years. They don't want to hurt themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them got tremendous clauses in their contract. If I would have had a selling clause in my contract when they sold me for $75,000, I would have had a piece of the action. Mm-hmm. But I didn't. But I didn't have an agent. And today the agents get everything figured out. From the moment you walk out of that door, the moment you come in the door, how many times you brush your teeth, how many times you got a bat in your hand, how many times you go up to the plate, how many times you strike out, how many times. It's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all computerized.
Yeah.
That's all, you can't lie in baseball anymore. Before you could lie. I'm 23, but I'm really 26. I'm 26, but I'm really 23. But all they do is press a button and check you out.
Yeah.
In the old days, you couldn't do it.
Uh-huh.
Not that quick, anyhow.
Yeah. How do you think baseball has helped you with ups and downs in life? Was there anything about building your character? Has it helped you in any way as you look back on your baseball career?
Dealing
with different personalities?
Yeah, baseball, I think baseball, well, I give baseball gave me everything I have. It made me keep myself in fairly good shape. Not talking now because I'm about 15 pounds overweight, but that's the rice and beans I love. But I've kept myself in fairly good shape for my age anyhow. And I think that's more or less. I've always looked back on my playing days. You know, like I go jogging, I walk in, whatever. I do a little weights just to keep my body trim also, or keep my body tight. And I think that baseball has given me a lot of thinking that way. I reminisce a lot about the game whenever I see a player. You know, we talked back in the old days how hard it was for us, but the good times we had. Mm-hmm. Today the players don't have they don't have as good times as we did. They don't. Our funds, the way we think fun today is the way they say you can't do this. You can't give a guy a half foot anymore. Well, they do it anyhow. Mm-hmm. But those are the things. You can't nail a guy's glove to the wall because in those days, now everything's concrete.
Yeah.
You know? You can't nail a guy's hat. I remember the first day I got to the big leagues, I pitched against, as a matter of fact, Vic Powell got the first hit off me against Cleveland. And I was in the bullpen. They took Chuck Staub. He's got about an eight hat. He took my hat, put my next to him, took his away. He took his glove. And I was sitting like this watching the game with my glove there. As soon as the bell rang, Rudy Hernandez, I picked up his glove, picked up his hat, put it out. Everyone started laughing. The catcher went out to catch me. He said, let's go. He didn't have a glove on. I said, where's the ball? Nobody had any balls. You know. I said, come on, there's a ball. Didn't you bring a ball out? I said, no. He said, yeah, you got to bring your own ball out. Everyone's got their own ball. See, I got my own ball. And they all threw balls at me. So it was it was a fun thing. Yeah. And I pitched three against Cleveland. Big Powell got the only hit off me, which I felt pretty good, Puerto Rican getting a hit off me. And then I met the presidents. Kennedy was, I went two administrations, the Kennedy administration and the Eisenhower administration. So there was a lot of fun in those days. Yeah, a lot of fun. More experienced ball players. Today, the guys make big money. They take care of themselves more. You don't see them with the public as much. You don't see them. They don't mingle no more. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they don't mingle. And they're more conservative. They're more conservative in that sense of the word. And they get involved with heavy drugs. I mean, guys are making big money. I mean, I'm not pointing fingers, but yeah. It comes out in the paper. So, you know, the public knows about that.
Well, as you say, they have a lot of money, and there's a lot of temptation out there and a lot of places to spend it.
Especially in the big cities, yeah.
And, you know, you have the whole Magic Johnson business, and, you know, a lot of these things unfortunately come out.
That's right. Keith Hernandez, Gooding, mm-hmm. Strawberry, mm-hmm. all those guys, you know, they play in the big cities. Somebody will come up to you and, you know, and make you an offer you can't refuse, you know, whether it's drugs, whether it's girls, whether it's investments, or, you know, they fall into that. They fall into that. Money is the root of all evil, but give me a lot of evil.
Yeah, right. Is there some aspect of your career that you don't think we've touched on? I know we've covered a lot of ground. Is there?
Well, you know, there was a time when you couldn't make money in the game. And now an astrologer is really a big thing. You know, like there was a card show here not too long ago in Puerto Rico. And I went over there and I saw what they were selling. I couldn't believe it. I turned around and I sold about $700-$800 worth of stuff before I turned around. Because stuff that I've had in my house. I'm a collector. I love flea markets. You know, I collect a lot. I got balls signed by Eisenhower. I got balls signed by Kennedy. And you know, to know the value of those things, you got to live in the States because here no one's interested in that.
Yeah. Oh, it's incredible, you know, what some of these kids and people, these dealers get for cards and memorabilia. And,
if my brother, God bless his soul, he passed away last year in a car accident. If I had boxes of cards at home, because I used to be an ace. I used to flip heads. I had to wreck in my neighborhood, like 30 heads in a row, and that's hard to do. I mean, I used to flip on top of cards. And, you know, to flip a head every time. It's a touch. It's a touch and it's luck too. So, and I had cards in my house. My brother, my father, God bless his soul, my mother, God bless her soul too, passed away. My brother went to New York without even Aunt telling me nothing. He took all my stuff. He thought it was gone. Those stuff, I have money. Lucky I managed to salvage some of the things. Like I had a giant jacket with leather sleeves, with a New York chenille on it. I sold that. After 10, 12, 14 years, 20 years, I sold that for $1,500. Mm-hmm. And somebody told me that I could have sold that for $3,000.
I'm sure.
And so these are the things that lay in your house. I mean, you know, I got a lot of pictures and everything. It's in my apartment. I live right down the street. And it's called Rudy's Hall of Fame. But who goes to my house and sees them? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, my daughters aren't interested in baseball. One's a swimmer, and the other was a basketball player, mm-hmm. you know. So when I have people out, I want to see your pictures. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to invite people. So actually, those things are more value to somebody else.
What about the Puerto Rican Baseball Hall of Fame? I know they just had a ceremony here recently where they inducted some people. Is there any talk about a building or any place where that stuff could be viewed by, you know, the young kids and by the Puerto Rican society?
Not that I know of. The interest here, let me tell you something. Mickey Mantle came down here there one time. They played exhibition game. And the only people I recognized them was one place went to, and they came for two other guys to sign with them all. It was Blanchard, there was Cleve Boyer, Pete Ramos, and myself. I took them all around. Hey, no one made a big fuss over him. Mickey Mantle couldn't get his head out of a cab before people were jumping all over the car to get his autograph. Latin people, I'm very thrilled for autographs. Yeah. Maybe some of the kids today are getting trend, but no big deal, no big deal. Mm-hmm. I went to the States with Orlando, but when he had his baseball school here, they named a field after him. We went to the Graham Hyatt, and we went there an hour. We came downstairs, there was about 10 kids out there with my picture, my baseball card, his picture, baseball. I said, what the heck is going on here? Yeah. I couldn't believe that. But the fans in the States, especially cards, you know, my card is worth 90 cents, and I don't sign any more cards because Frank Robinson told me, he said, these kids are making a big business out of it.
Yeah.
And people say, sign the cards. All right, yeah. If you're rich, sign them. If you're not rich, hey, you can get some money from them.
Yeah.
I know the fans are the ones that make the players, but a lot of the guys make a business out of you signing their cards. Mm-hmm. It's a big business.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate your taking some time out to talk with me, and as I said, you're going to Hall of Fame.
Well, thank you very much, Frank. I really appreciate that.
Yeah,
really like that.
But I think it's important to begin to document some of the historical perspectives of the Latin ball players, because being up in New York and being involved now with the Society for American Baseball Research, I just feel that there's a void there of the Latin perspective and what it was like.
Well, that's good, because you know, no one would think of doing what you're doing. I think you're doing a great thing for us, because I would never believe. I mean, you know, one day I like to take my daughter to see my name in the Hall of Fame.
Sure,
see?
Sure.
And she can say, Daddy was in the Hall of Fame. And you know, it's a funny thing that you taught that, because I was talking to Deacon Jones last night, and he says, you know something? If somebody asks you, who was the first black ever registered in the Hall of Fame? He was. Yeah. He was the number one in the nation, I think it was, of amateur baseball.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was voted the best player in America. And so his name appeared in the registry. This is going to be in the registry, right?
Yeah.
In the Hall of Fame.
Well, I would hope someday that maybe there's a Puerto Rican Hall of Fame where I can put these tapes there, but they're certainly going to be out in Cooperstown for anybody, you know, to take a look at some point.
And, good. What day?
Well, as soon as I get back to the States,
I make
a copy of it and send it on out to Cooperstown.
Did you know I've never been to Cooperstown?
Yeah, it's a lovely town.
I gotta go there.
It's a lovely town.
I got my little one lives in Connecticut. My big one's coming in a couple of weeks from Chile. She spends her vacation with me, and I told her I'd take her there.
Mm-hmm.
Take her there,
you know? Yeah, it's worth it.
Yeah, it's worth it.
It's a little tough in the wintertime, you know, getting out there and the roads, and you never know what the weather is going to be like with the snow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But in the summertime and the spring, it's...
Have you been there?
Well, I only live about an hour from Cooperstown.
Where do you live?
In Albany.
Albany, New York.
Albany, New York. So we're only about an hour from Cooperstown.
Isn't
so it's a neat... You can do it in a day. Go out and do the museum and all that. So... thanks again.
Hey, Frank, it's a pleasure.
Uh-huh.
I hope you lots of luck.
Okay.
Who else did you get on this one?